Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Early this month, flags across Montana were flown at half-mast. Nearly 1,000 people filled the Montana Pavilion in Billings to honor war veteran Ben Steele. We interviewed Ben several years ago. What he had to say is very much worth hearing. When I was growing up in the 1950s and people referred to the war, there was no question what they were talking about, World War II. It was fully global, spanned 6 years, cost 70 to 80 million human lives, and ended in total defeat of the fascist alliance of Germany, Italy, and Japan. Human memory tends to simplify, and in remembering the war, the early terrible defeats are often overlooked. But Ben Steele hasn't forgotten them. He was in the United States Army in the Philippines when it was overrun by the Japanese, was a prisoner of war for more than 3 years under the most terrible conditions, and survived the infamous Bataan Death March. Ben Steele, many thanks for having us to your home in Billings.
Thank you.
Now, you're about how old?
I was 22.
Then. How old are you now?
94.
Well, you look about 84. You've aged well.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your background. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Roundup, Montana, and raised on a cattle ranch about 30 miles east and south of Roundup in the Bull Mountains.
What year were you born?
1917.
So you were then growing up on a cattle ranch in the 20s and during the height of the Depression.
Right.
How was it as a way of life for you looking back?
Well, things were pretty tough because we had the drought along with the Depression. It was hard to make a living out in that country because it's kind of a tough country to make a living in. We survived until 1932, and then we moved off the ranch, and we just walked off the ranch.
You just left it?
We just walked it off and turned it back to the Federal Land Bank.
What did your folks do then?
My dad, who came in, he was a bootlegger. And otherwise, on WPA.
Works Progress Administration.
Right.
But he was a bootlegger.
Trying to make a living for the family, you know.
Before we talk about bootlegging a little bit, I need to mention, first, I'm talking a little louder than usual because you lost your hearing, you told me, part of your hearing in World War II.
Right.
Second, much of the story that we're going to talk about is told in this book, Tears in the Darkness, the story of the Bataan Death March and its aftermath, by Michael and Elizabeth Norman. I have to say it's a very well-written book. Were you directly involved in the work with the authors?
Oh, I worked with them for 10 years on it.
Well, it shows. It's a very, very carefully researched and well-written book.
It is.
Now, let me ask you about the cowboy part of your upbringing on the ranch. What did you learn from that?
I learned a lot about survival. We lived in kind of a hostile country, you know, where hard winters and during the Depression. And my dad was a pretty, he tried to make me learn a lot when I was very young. I worked on the hay field and everything when I was 9 years old. Mowed hay and I raked hay and I rode horses, of course. We had a lot of horses, and my dad was a great horseman, so I grew up on a horse.
What did that teach you about survival?
Dad taught me so much about it because he was an old cowboy on the open range, and I knew how to build fires, and I knew how to take care of myself if I got out in the elements.
There's a scene in the book. You had to push horses a long way, and it was incredibly cold.
I was about 16 years old at that time, and we had horses over north, and of course we were in Billings, and Dad sent me out. We had people that took care of our horses for a while, and he sold his team of horses, and they were wild horses. You know, they hadn't been in, around people and out on the range all the time and never been in a corral. So he sent me out to get this team of horses, which are big 1,400-pound horses, and we had to choke them down to get halters on them, and it was kind of the middle of the winter, and we choked these two horses down, put halters on them, and tied their heads together, and I led them 30 miles. I had to open gates, you know, with them out on the end of a lariat, and they pulled back and jerked my horse down a couple of times. I led him for 30 miles all in one day.
And it was cold, if I remember right.
It was, yeah. It wasn't severely cold. It's probably 10 below.
Looking back, would you say your dad was too hard on you?
I kind of appreciated what he did in later on in life because he taught me a lot. He wasn't, I always say, all that hard on me. He just demanded that I do certain things and do them right. And I was very young, of course. Mother used to say, you're going to kill that kid if you don't. You're doing having him do things that you should be doing yourself.
So your mother maybe thought he was too hard on you.
Yeah.
Now let's talk briefly about bootlegging. He did it for family survival. You were aware of it, right? There's a scene where you're driving a truck that's loaded with lumber.
Oh, yeah.
And under hidden is whiskey, and when a cork pops, it starts pouring out on the street.
Oh, yeah.
So you knew what was going on.
I did.
And how'd you feel about it?
So I didn't think too much about it at that time. I was out at the still, and he loaded me up with about 150 gallons of whiskey and, you know, kegs and driving them into Billings. And when I stopped to get an ice cream cone in Warden, Montana, and one of the kegs turned over and ran out on the street. And I came out, and although you could smell the thing for a block, you know, and I got the keg turned back, but it was emptied out, and got in the truck because I knew we were kind of in trouble, and drove right through Billings, right up Broadwater Avenue to our house up on Broadwater, and unloaded the rest of the whiskey.
Now, they arrested your dad, didn't they, eventually?
Later on, they arrested my dad and put him in jail, and there's 150 gallons they didn't find, and Mother and I peddled that whiskey. I was in high school, and that's what we lived on for 6 months. 150 gallons of whiskey at $3 a gallon.
I regret we're going to have to jump over a lot of things that are very, very interesting in your story because we only have half an hour. But I do recommend to our listeners that you seriously consider getting the book Tears in the Darkness. Why did you join the Army and when?
Well, a mother came down to see me. I was working on a ranch down on the Crow Reservation, and she says, you know, you should join the Army because they're going to draft. And the draft was a little part of the conscription, they called it at that time. And she says, you ought to join the Army. And I said, well, I didn't know anything about the military, you know. So I thought, that might be a good idea, go to California, and that sounds interesting and adventurous. And so I come in and join the Army, and I went into the recruiting office, and I said, I want to join the military. And she said, well, we have the Army, the Navy, and we have Air Corps. So I said, I'll take the Air Corps. So I joined the Air Corps.
When was this?
That was in October of 1940.
So it was a year and 2 months before Pearl Harbor,
right.
The attack on Pearl Harbor.
So I went to March Field.
How good was the training you got?
Well, I don't think it was all that great, because I took 6 weeks of recruit training at March Field, and I really wound up a truck driver for a while. So we didn't have fire rifles or anything.
You're telling me you didn't fire rifles
as
part of basic training.
Well, it is as far as I'm concerned, but in the Air Corps, they didn't do that at that time. They gave you pistol training.
How seriously did you and your fellow recruits take the possibility of having to fight in war? You join the Army, it could, you know, okay, it's a nice way to go to California, you said, but did you seriously think you were going to have to go fight the Japanese or the Germans?
We didn't, well, you know, things were getting a little difficult at that time, but we didn't have any idea we were going to get into a war. I went from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to the Philippines in 1941, right 6 weeks prior to Pearl Harbor. We didn't know anything about fighting.
So you're 6 weeks before Pearl Harbor. You're sent to you arrive in the Philippines. General MacArthur is the commander of that theater, correct?
Yeah, he was our supreme commander.
Tell me about hearing about Pearl Harbor. How did you hear about it?
Well, it's on the morning of December the 8th over there. We woke up one morning, we heard Pearl Harbor had been bombed, and we didn't think too much of it, but we thought we'd be the first to get hit because we were the closest military establishment to Japan. And they hit us at noon on the same day as Pearl Harbor. And with 54 heavy bombers and about, 100 fighter planes, completely wiped us out.
Now, you had an airfield and planes there in the Philippines.
We had B-17s. We had about 15 B-17s. Because half of our group went south to Mindanao before the Pearl Harbor. And we lost them all.
We are talking with Ben Steele, World War II veteran and survivor of the Bataan Death March. The Japanese followed up that air raid with a military attack, and you end up with about 100,000 troops on the American side with Filipinos fighting the Japanese army, and they gradually push you back down the Bataan Peninsula. About how long was that fighting?
Well, we were almost 4 months in the battle.
And were you personally in combat?
I was personally in the front lines. What they did, they came up with rifles to us guys that we didn't have anything to do after they shot up all our planes and said, we're going to put you in the infantry. So they brought a truckload of rifles, and we all took a rifle, and they sent us to the front lines and dropped us off right on the front lines and said, dig in here for the battle. We stayed on that line for 4 months.
It's incredible just at one level with having had no training in infantry tactics or fighting, you're put in that position. That's just the way it was. That's just the way it happened.
Yeah. We were scared to death, of course.
Now, you're a kid out of the country. You had used guns growing up in Montana.
I was one of the only ones that knew how to fire a rifle. And one of my jobs was going up and down the lines and teaching guys how to fire an 03, a Springfield 03. And I'd show them how to load it and how to fire it and how to aim it and that sort of thing. We were really not too prepared there. I used to think, what are we going to do if we get a spearhead right here? And we wouldn't have been able to handle it.
You mean an attack by the Japanese?
Right, a spearhead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when the lines broke after 4 months on April the 7th, they had thousands of Japanese coming in, and they flanked us on our left and under Filipinos. Because we'd have probably done pretty well where we were, but not too well, because we had open fields and everything.
So the Japanese attacked heavily, and eventually General King surrendered.
Yes.
Now, before we discuss the Bataan Death March, it's my understanding from the book that General MacArthur promised the troops you would get reinforcements. Is that correct? But it didn't happen.
Oh, it was impossible. After Pearl Harbor, they destroyed the Navy pretty well, and we had to have Navy to get in there because we were surrounded by sea for 1,000 miles. We were isolated up there.
What were your thoughts when you faced surrendering to the Japanese? What did you expect was going to happen?
Well, we knew it was going to happen. We knew we were doomed because we couldn't hold the place.
Okay, but when now they say...
we used to talk about it.
What did you say?
And we'd say, well, we're either going to be prisoners of war or we're going to be dead, with the only two alternatives we have. And neither one of them was very too appetizing. We knew we were going to get captured or killed, one or the other.
All right, your general surrenders the troops, the army.
He did. He saved our lives, yeah.
All right, you've got to march 60 miles to get to a railroad station.
Well, then, of course, after we surrendered, the next morning on April the 10th, we started the so-called Death March of Bataan. And I was on it about a week. But I hadn't eaten in 3 days when I was caught. So I say I went 9 days without a meal. And walked the death march.
So the Japanese provided no food to the troops?
No.
What about water?
We didn't get enough water. You have to have water. But we drank some water that was too thick to drink, you know.
What do you mean, too thick to drink?
Well, it was polluted water and not good water. It was a contaminated water. We drank out of rice paddies and mud holes or anything that was liquid. And we didn't get near enough of it. I've been close to choking from not having enough water. There were artesian wells along the way, and they'd fight us off the water. They wouldn't let us have it.
The guards driving the march would not let you get to water.
Why, right.
What happens if you try?
Well, you get killed. If you pushed it too far, you'd either get a bayonet or a bullet, you know.
Now, you're saying that. That are things that you saw?
I saw them do that, yeah. I never got... I used to get water some way. I don't know, remember just how I did, but I used to get into the artesian well and get some water.
Now, I remember a scene, and you're going to have to help me here, where there was, I think, a wounded man, or he was sick, one of the two. He fell down. You picked him up and tried to help hold him up.
I didn't even know the guy, but he grabbed me by the leg and asked me to help him, and I tried to help him. I was getting kind of weak myself. And so I struggled along with him and with my arm around him, and another guy was helping me a little bit. And the job came along because the column wasn't moving fast enough. And he made me drop him, and they killed him, and I went on, of course, into the group.
How did they make you drop him?
Well, they just pointed a bayonet at me and said, "You drop the man or else I'll get you too," you know.
At one point, someone stabbed you with a bayonet.
Well, that was him. He did that. That was one of the ways he prodded me to get him to drop him. He stuck me in the butt with a bayonet, and I didn't get hurt all that bad. I lost quite a bit of blood, but I think it hit a bone or something and stopped the penetration.
When men in the march, prisoners, could not continue, what happened to them? If they fell, where they were tired, they were exhausted?
They killed them. They had cleanup squads coming behind the columns. And you could hear gunshot wounds along the way where they were shooting guys and bayoneting them. So that's kind of an incentive to keep going. So I tried to stay up in the front of the lines, you know, the columns. I was in pretty good shape, really.
We are talking with Ben Steele, World War II veteran and survivor of the Bataan Death March. My recollection is there were about 70,000 men that started on the march. How many died?
10,000 died, they claim. That was an estimate, of course.
At the end of the march, you get to a railroad station. You're all put in box cars where it's almost impossible to breathe. And a guy, I'm just telling you what's in the book because we're pressed for time. You get a place where you can breathe, and a guy says...
Well, there were metal cars, and they closed the doors, and it was 100 degrees or more outside.
And a guy told you to...
We were suffocating in the cars because we couldn't get our breath in there. We trying to get a nose in the crack to breathe.
You know? You had a nose in the crack to breathe, and a guy said, "Move or I'll break your neck."
So,
correct?
Yeah, and guys died in the cars.
Right. So then you get to the prison camp. What was it like?
Well, it was an old Philippine Army camp, and there was no sanitary facilities, no cooking facilities. They brought in big vats to cook rice in, and we dug trenches for latrines. And from the effects of the march, you guys had malaria and they had dysentery, and the men started to die right away. And we buried 2,300 of the 10,000 Americans within 6 weeks.
2,300 died within 6 weeks.
And I was on the burial detail there. And every morning I'd go out and they'd put me in the burial detail digging holes. And we used to dig big holes, and about 30 in a hole or more, in mass graves.
Now, in the book, it describes the consequences of dysentery, and there were other diseases, but that was the most lethal, as there's human excrement everywhere. There's no getting away from it.
Yeah, right. Well, guys that die and fall into the trenches. We used to pull them out of the dysentery trenches out of the and bury them, haul them out of there. I remember going out and had maybe four or five guys died in the trenches. And some guys that just lay there because they had dysentery so bad, they didn't go back to the area. So there'd be guys laying all around the trenches with dysentery.
That scene is like out of hell.
Yeah.
What did you think? What did you think was going to happen to you?
Well, we didn't know. We used to think we're all going to die, we thought at one time. So just when is it going to happen? And after a while, I volunteered for a detail out of there because it was so bad. Well, I used to haul guys into what they call a dysentery ward or zero ward. And actually, maggots all over the floor. And you take a guy in there and he'd give up right away, you know.
It's where people died, just yeah. Went to die.
And sometimes we wouldn't get the guys for 4 or 5 days, and the maggots had taken over, and they'd be litter loads of maggots, you know.
On a person.
Yeah. I volunteered for a detail and went south. There were 325 of us, and I'm one of 50 guys that survived that. It was worse than a death march.
I remember reading about the construction in the jungle.
Tiabas Road.
Trying to build a road with shovels
in
the jungle.
Yeah, and it was in the rain, and we'd sleep all day in the rain, and we'd cook rice in wheelbarrows, and it was half raw.
And 50 men out of 300 survived.
Yeah.
Now, there's a scene I want to read, and I don't remember where this is in the book. In other words, I've got it marked here. This is you, and you have malaria, I guess, and you're dying of thirst. You feel like you're dying of thirst. He could hear men inside talking. He could also hear a canteen cap clanking against the side of a flask. The officers, that's American officers, had water. "Please, sirs," he yelled as loud as he could. "Please, can I have a drink?" No one answered. Maybe they didn't hear him. "Please, sirs, I need water." He passed out again, that's you, came to, passed out a third time. It was late afternoon. He waited for the sun to set. If I understand this, these are American officers who have water refusing to open the door and help an enlisted man.
Well, I'm sure they had water inside the house. I was on this daily detail, and I got malaria, and coming back to the area, I passed out and fell by the roadside. And then I crawled up into the shade of this building. There was an officer, it was an officer's quarters, and that's when that happened. And I finally got back to the area, and my friend gave me a drink of water.
I'm going to read another excerpt. By November 1942, Ben Steele was doing better. He was still sick with malaria, beriberi, dysentery, and jaundice, but he seemed on the mend. Now, that's a hell of a way to be on the mend if you had all those diseases. It's amazing to me that you...
I know, I did, though.
And that you survived.
I had beriberi, too. Maybe I don't know how I'm here. Because I almost died with beriberi, where I swelled up and said, when you starve. That's the first thing you get when you starve to death. Is beriberi, and that's when you can't pass water, and it all goes into your system. And I bet I weighed close to 300 pounds of that stuff, full of water.
Now, you say you're 300 pounds, but I remember when you started, you're 5'10", 150 pounds. At one point, you're 110 pounds.
Yeah.
And then you balloon up to 300 pounds because you can't pass liquid.
Yeah, with water, because my eyes were swollen shut, and I had my head was all swollen. I'd wake up and my head would be lopsided, and water moved from one side to the other.
You're a prisoner of war in these kind of conditions for 42 months. How did you hear the Japanese had surrendered?
Well, that this came one day in Japan, we were working coal mines, and the commander came in, and he says, nobody goes to work today. And then he made the announcement that Japanese had surrendered, and the war was over.
What was the reaction of you and your men?
We were all cheering and crying and everything else, and because we were so elated over it all. And we didn't really believe all he said until planes came over and dropped us leaflets, the American planes, and told us what to do.
Mr. Steele, you've had almost 70 years since the surrender of the Japanese to think about these things, and I want to ask you a couple of questions. One, looking back, what do you think of the conduct of the American officers in your area?
Well, we didn't have all that good a leadership over there. And I have a lot of respect for some of the officers, but we didn't have a lot of good leadership there. I mean, and MacArthur was one of them.
When you say that, why MacArthur?
Well, he didn't make good decisions, as far as I'm concerned. He used to tell us and lie to us about help coming in and never came.
And he knew it wasn't coming? Are you saying he knew it wasn't
coming? He would say, well, help us 72 hours out, so hold out on the front lines.
I see.
And we would believe him for a while. Till pretty quick we'd quit.
And what's your assessment of your fellow enlisted men who went through what you went through?
Well, I just kind of like myself. We did a pretty good job. And I admire them both. We have a very strong bond between us. We have organizations that we...
Those who made it, those who survived.
Yeah, well, we meet, you know. We have a national organization that used to meet every year, and it still does with the descendants, because we don't have many of us left.
You must have deeply hated the Japanese soldiers and guards who were in charge of that march and those camps. After 70 years, how do you feel about them?
You know, I forgive the Japanese, because war is war. And what you can't make rules for war, in my way of thinking, and you have to forgive after it's all over. I had Japanese students, you know. I became a professor, and I had Japanese students, and they kind of talked me out of being angry.
You were angry, though.
I was.
And those young people, those students, helped talk you out of it?
Yeah, they used to tell me, you can't hate us all, you know. And I said, there's too damn many of you, you know. And so I forgive the Japanese. I have Japanese friends now.
Does that surprise you?
And I was hard for me to do to start with, because I didn't like them, and that was for several years. But I had Japanese students, and they used to talk to me, and we got to be pretty good friends. I still have Japanese friends. Hatred is a very destructive force, and you have to get over it.
Ben Steele, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground and what you did for our country.
Thank you.
To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is a production of Artemis Common Ground, which is solely responsible for its content. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. Contact us at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, High Stakes, Norcross, Humanities Montana, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to present and future generations of Montanans.